Part 5. Sampling and Validation.
Chapter 19. The moment theory becomes a physical thing. Welcome back. So in part 4, you build the brief. Every material, every dimension, every surface finish. Written down, documented, sent. You did the work. The factory read it. And now, you wait. And then a box arrives. This is the moment everything changes. Because up until now, the product existed on a screen, in a spreadsheet, in your head. And now it exists in three dimensions. With weight. And texture, and sometimes a smell you weren't expecting. This is where sampling begins, and this is where a lot of importers quietly stop being in control, because they treat this phase like a checkpoint to get past as fast as possible, rather than what it actually is, the most important gate in the entire process. Think about everything that's happened before this moment. The product idea, the market research, the supplier search, the brief. All of it has been based on assumptions. Logical ones, well-researched ones, but assumptions. Assumptions about how a material will feel. Assumptions about how a proportion will look. Assumptions about whether a closure that worked in a sketch will work in a hand. Paper is very forgiving. Reality is not. So here's the fundamental truth of this entire phase. A first sample is not supposed to be perfect. I'll say that again because half of you just flinched. A first sample is not supposed to be perfect. It's supposed to show you what's possible, not what's final. Its job is to make the invisible visible. And the things it makes visible are exactly the things that would have quietly destroyed your production run if you hadn't seen them now. What does it actually reveal? Materials that behave differently in hand than they behaved in a spec sheet. Proportions that look balanced in a CAD drawing and feel slightly off when you pick them up. A button that seemed crisp on paper and wobbled slightly in practice. Details that were crystal clear in the brief and apparently had a surprising amount of interpretive room when a factory technician read them at 6 in the morning. These are not manufacturing failures. These are discoveries. And this is the mindset shift that separates experienced importers from people on their first or second run. Sampling is not a single event. It is a structured iteration process. You are not looking for perfection in round one. You are sharpening, round by round, toward a product that can be manufactured stably and repeatedly at scale. Multiple rounds are not a sign of inefficiency. They are a sign of control. People who expect to approve the first sample either got lucky or they're about to discover why you never rely on luck. There's a cost side to this that people underestimate, and then there's the real cost. Budgeting for the sampling phase, meaning the whole process, shipping from Asia included, customs, revisions, tooling adjustments, multiple rounds, typically runs anywhere from $500 to $5,000 depending on the product category. More for technically complex things. That sounds like real money, until you compare it to what a single misproduction costs. And misproductions are always more expensive than the entire sampling budget combined. Always. Sampling is the cheapest insurance in the whole operation. The deductible for skipping it tends to arrive by container. Here's another thing the book spends real time on. The cost question of who pays for samples has to be settled before you order, not after. Some manufacturers absorb the first sample and apply it to the order. Others bill every sample separately. Some offer free samples, made from their standard materials, not your specification. Get clear on this upfront, or you get a surprise invoice at best and a sample that has nothing to do with your brief at worst. Neither of those is a fun way to start a supplier relationship. And here's what you get at the end of a clean sampling process that might be more valuable than the product itself. Understanding. Understanding of how this product actually behaves, where its real tolerances lie, which adjustments were necessary, which details the factory naturally gets right, and which ones need extra attention every single time. That knowledge doesn't just help this production run. It shapes every follow-up order, every reorder conversation, every QC brief you write for the next 2 years with this manufacturer. Sampling done well means production runs smoothly. Sampling skipped or rushed means production becomes a permanent construction site. You choose.
Chapter 20. The sample types. What each one is actually proving.
Alright, so you understand the phase. Now let's talk about what happens inside it. Because here's a mistake even experienced buyers make. They ask the factory for a sample and then wonder why they received something that answered the wrong question. There are multiple types of samples, not because the industry enjoys complications, but because each one is designed to answer a different question. Conflate them and you end up evaluating a product at the wrong moment for the wrong purpose, which means you miss problems or you reject something that wasn't supposed to be perfect yet. So let's go through them one by one. The first one you'll encounter is the stock sample, sometimes called a catalog sample. And this is not a developed sample at all. It's a finished product the factory already makes. It shows you the baseline, what quality level they operate at, how things feel in hand, what their workmanship actually looks like. No customization, no changes. Just, is this manufacturer worth talking to further? The value of a stock sample is purely in speed and cost, sometimes available in days, often free or a small fee plus shipping. It's the factory's business card. Nothing more, but nothing less either. Whoever doesn't request one before entering development is skipping the cheapest test in the entire process. And then they discover, after 3 rounds of custom development, that the manufacturer's baseline quality was never what they needed. Next, the customized sample or adapted sample. This is the most common entry point for private label. You take an existing product from the manufacturer's line and apply surface level changes. Your logo, a new color, a different print, adjusted packaging. The product structure stays the same. The advantage is real. Low development cost, short lead time, manageable risk. The product already exists in series production. You're only changing the surface. But there's a line here that matters. The moment you change materials, dimensions, functions, or construction details, you have crossed out of a customized sample and into real product development. And that changes what the sample costs, how long it takes, and what expectations are realistic. A typical mistake, framing extensive changes as a small adjustment and expecting the manufacturer to treat it as a customization. What looks like a small tweak to you can be an entirely new production process to the person who has to make it.
Third, the concept sample. This is the first physical approximation of a product you're developing from scratch. And the keyword here is approximation. The goal is not to get something beautiful. The goal is to answer one question. Does the idea basically work? Do the proportions hold up? Does the basic mechanism function in principle? These are often 3D prints, rough hand-built mock-ups, prototypes assembled from available materials. Quality is intentionally low. Speed is intentionally high. A concept sample should take days, not weeks. Whoever expects color accuracy or surface quality at this stage is spending energy on exactly the wrong questions. This is not the stage for that. Fourth, the functional sample, sometimes called an engineering sample. Now the question shifts, not does it work in principle, but does it work technically? Does the lid fit? Does the hinge hold up? Does the closure snap in clean? Does the electronics module seat correctly? The material here should be as close to the final specification as possible, because you're testing mechanical behavior, and that changes with material. This is where the problems that were invisible on screen finally reveal themselves. Wall thicknesses that are too thin, tolerances that don't align, threads that don't catch. These findings are not a setback. They are the reason this sample exists. Every deviation between brief and functional sample gets documented, not as a complaint, but as the agenda for the next iteration. Fifth, the design sample or appearance sample. Now we shift entirely to aesthetics. Form, color, surface, print, finish, everything should come as close as possible to the final product. Technical function is less important here. Appearance is everything. And this one has to be evaluated under realistic conditions. Not on a white desk under studio lighting, on a shelf, in packaging, next to the competition. Colors look different in daylight than under an office lamp. Surfaces feel different than they appear in a rendering. Proportions that looked harmonious on screen can feel slightly wrong in a hand. This is the sample that shows you whether your product will look like it belongs in the market, or like it tried. 6. The pre-production sample, or PPS. This is where things get serious. The PPS is the first sample made under near-serious conditions, produced on the final tooling, from the specified series material, under the same process conditions as the actual production run. The question has completely changed now. It's no longer, can we make this? It's, can we make this consistently? And this is why PPS are always ordered in multiples, 3 to 5 pieces, not as spares, as a test of consistency. If 3 samples lie side by side and are identical, that signals a stable process. If they deviate from each other, the product is not ready for approval, regardless of how good any individual piece looks. A single good sample proves you got lucky once. 3 identical samples prove the process works. And finally, the golden sample.
which is not technically a separate type of sample. It's a change of status. It is the PPS that passed review, tested, written up, approved with documentation. From that moment on, it is no longer a test subject. It is the binding reference for the entire series production. The factory will not interpret it. They will copy it. Machines, workers, QC, all of them oriented to this one physical object. Which means whatever you approved in that sample gets manufactured 100 times or 10,000 times. What's in the box is in the contract. Regardless of what you thought you'd communicated. The golden sample gets its own full chapter coming up, because the distribution system around it matters enormously. For now, just hold the status distinction. PPS is a test subject. Golden sample is the law. Bottom line, each sample type answers a different question. Concept, does the idea work? Functional, does the technology hold? Design, does the appearance land? PPS, can it be produced consistently? Golden, is this the standard? Skip or conflate any of these stages and you push problems forward into production, where they cost 10 times as much to fix. Which is the point of no return, where they stop being problems and start being container contents.
Chapter 21. Testing against reality and the competition. So you've received a sample you're broadly happy with. The concept works, the technology holds, the appearance is close. Now the question is, does it hold up to the world? Not to your idea of it, to the world. Because here's the thing people miss. A sample evaluated in isolation gives you limited information. It tells you whether the product basically functions. It does not tell you whether it can hold its own in the market. And customers don't compare your product to your own intentions. They compare to the 3 alternatives one click away. The market is already there. It's already defined. It is not waiting for someone new. It's waiting for someone better. That's why benchmarking against competitors is not optional. It's not a step for the particularly thorough. It's an integral part of the sampling process. Without a reference point, every evaluation is little more than a gut feeling wearing a professional coat. So the approach is simple, and more people should do it. While you are reviewing your sample, you buy the top 3 to 5 competing products in your target market. The best sellers, the ones with the most reviews, the ones sitting right where you want to sit. And you put them on the table next to your sample. Right there, side by side, under the same lighting, in your hands, back and forth. Because things that feel solid in isolation can suddenly feel average in comparison. And your own strengths only become visible when the competitor's weaknesses become visible. How does the material feel? How clean are the edges? How sturdy does the construction feel under pressure? How does the product smell? That last one is more important than people want to admit, especially for plastics and textiles. A product that smells wrong does not get 5 stars. It gets a return and a very descriptive review. How does the packaging hold up? What does the unboxing experience feel like? That last one is chronically underestimated. The customer makes their verdict about whether the purchase was worth it precisely at the moment they open the box, not after using it for a week, in the first 30 seconds. And on Amazon especially, comparison orders are now standard. Customers order 3 or 4 versions of the same product, try them at home side by side, and return the ones that don't win. Your product is not going to be judged in isolation on a shelf. It's going to be judged on a kitchen table next to the competition in 30 seconds by someone who is ready to return it for free with 2 clicks. Whoever hasn't done that comparison themselves before the customer does it has no control over how it turns out. The customer runs the benchmark anyway. The only question is whether you ran it first. Run it first.
Now functional testing. And I want to be very specific about what this means, because we tested it often means someone picked it up, nodded and put it back down. That is not a test. That is an inspection of a product under ideal conditions. Real testing means treating the product the way a real customer will treat it, including everything that can go wrong in the process. 4 steps and each one matters. First, define the use scenario. Before you test anything, be clear about what is actually being tested. How is this product used day to day? How often? Under what conditions? A water bottle is opened and closed dozens of times a day, goes into a bag, occasionally gets dropped, regularly goes in the dishwasher. That is your test framework, not does it work when handled carefully by someone who built it. The realistic scenario. Second, test the load limits. Every product has a point at which it fails. You want to find that point in your own office, not in an Amazon review. Closures don't get tested 10 times. They get tested 100 times. Seams get put under actual load, not just inspected visually. Hinges get moved beyond the normal range of motion. Electronics don't run for an hour. They run for 48 hours. Testing only whether something works doesn't tell you when it stops working. And the customer who writes broke after 2 weeks did not care about your factory's QC report. Third, simulate the conditions. Products don't live in air-conditioned showrooms. They sit in a car in summer. They get left in a damp bathroom. They go from a freezing garage to a warm kitchen. They spend 3 weeks in a warehouse at 35 degrees Celsius and high humidity. Test materials under heat, humidity, UV exposure. Wash and dry textiles at least 5 cycles. Drop the packaged product from table height. That simulates warehouse and delivery conditions better than any theory. And it tells you whether the packaging that looked great on screen actually protects the product that needs to survive it.
Fourth, document and classify every result. 3 categories, cleanly separated. Critical, product fails at its core function or presents a safety risk. Stop, fix before anything moves forward. Relevant, noticeable defect that will generate returns or negative reviews. Fix before approval. Cosmetic, deviation the end customer probably won't notice. Decide by cost benefit. Documenting only pass or fail loses all the nuance. And the nuance is usually exactly where the money is. And for every result, ask yourself this one question. Would a customer who paid full price for this product, who had 4 alternatives available, who will leave a review, would that person accept this detail? Not whether you could personally live with it, not whether it's technically still within tolerance, whether a paying customer who chose between 5 alternatives would be satisfied with it. That perspective is uncomfortable. It is also the only one that counts. Now let me give you the benchmarking structure, because gut feeling is unreliable at scale. A simple evaluation grid is entirely enough. 6 dimensions. Material quality. Feel, durability, odor, workmanship. Workmanship. Seams, adhesives, fits, edges, surface finish. Function. Mechanics, stability, ease of use, how it holds up over time. Design. Aesthetics, proportions, color consistency, attention to detail. Packaging. Protective effectiveness, presentation, unboxing experience, information content. And price to value. Where does your product stand relative to what the competition offers for the same money?
Chapter 22. The golden sample. The reference that governs everything. Alright, so you've been through the sample types. You've tested, you've benchmarked, you've iterated. And now you arrive at the moment everyone thinks is a formality, but is actually one of the highest stakes decisions in the entire process. The transition from development to production. And the physical object that marks that transition, the golden sample. Let's be precise about what it is, because people conflate it with the PPS all the time, and actually that conflation is partly correct and partly dangerous. The PPS and the golden sample are often the same physical object. The difference is not in the thing, it's in the status. A PPS is a test subject. It gets evaluated. It can fail. It can go back for revision. The golden sample is a PPS that passed. Evaluated, documented, approved in writing. From that moment on, it is no longer under review. It is the law. The factory will not interpret this sample. They will copy it. Every machine, every worker, every internal QC check will be oriented to this one physical reference point. Everything in the golden sample that you approved, intentionally or not, will be reproduced. 100 times, 1,000 times. Whatever is in that sample is the product. Which is why the phrase, "I thought the factory would figure that out," becomes completely meaningless from this point on. They figured it out. They figured out what the golden sample said. Here's the scenario that plays out more often than anyone wants to admit. You receive a sample. It looks clean. You approve it. The factory has their own unit from the same batch. You assume you're both looking at the same thing. Except the factory's unit has a slightly different color intensity, an uneven seam on one side, a material that feels marginally different. Nobody compared them. The factory uses their unit as the production reference. You approved a different one. Both parties are convinced they're doing the right thing. The series comes in and doesn't match what you signed off on. No bad faith, no fraud, just 2 different reference points that nobody verified against each other.
And now you have 10,000 units of the wrong product in a warehouse quietly judging you. Just like chapter 1. This is exactly why PPS are always ordered in multiples and why the process for handling those multiples matters enormously. At minimum, 3 identical samples, and the sequence of how they're distributed is not a logistics question, it's a control question. The samples do not go directly from factory to customer. They first go to a central review point, a sourcing agency, a QC function, an internal ownership authority. There, all 3 samples are placed side by side, compared directly. Materials, workmanship, color, tactile feel, dimensions, details. Not to find a nice sample, to confirm that all of them are identical. Because if they are not identical, if there is visible variation between units from the same batch, the product is not approved. Not regardless of how good any individual piece looks. This is the point. Variation between samples is not a detail problem. It's a clear signal that the production process is not yet stable. And an unstable process scaled to 1,000 units does not become more stable at scale. It becomes more expensive.
Assuming all 3 samples are confirmed identical, now comes the distribution. And there's a structure to it. One sample goes to you, the customer. This is your market side reference. You approve it. It represents what you expect to receive in production. A second sample stays with the sourcing agency or QC function. This is the inspection reference. When a factory QC or third-party inspection happens during or after production, this is what the inspector compares against. Not memory, not notes, not a specification on paper, a physical object. A third sample goes back to the factory, where it lives as the production reference. The factory's own workers, their own internal QC, all of them oriented to this one unit. Everyone is working from the same thing. Without this three-way split, information gaps between the customer, QC, and production almost always develop, and information gaps become quality gaps. And quality gaps become returns. Now, what does approval actually mean? Because people treat it as a nod, a sign of, a yes, it is not. Approving the golden sample means you are forfeiting the right to later interpretation. From this moment on, whatever is in that sample is what gets produced. Any detail present in the golden sample that you didn't like but didn't catch, now that detail is in series production. 10,000 times. Statements like "the factory should have caught that" have no footing anymore. The factory produced the reference. The reference was approved, which means this review is not a formality to rush through at the end of a long development cycle. It is the moment where careful beats fast, every single time. Let me give you the practical list of what gets reviewed before approving a golden sample. The full detail is in the book, but here's the shape of it. Materials against specification. Workmanship under good lighting and direct handling. Dimensions checked against the brief. Not just felt, actually measured. Colors against the approved color reference. Tactile feel, because sometimes the only way to catch a wrong material is with your hands. Any functional elements, closures, hinges, electronics, tested one more time under realistic conditions. Packaging structure, labeling compliance, and anything regulatory relevant. And then the check that nobody loves but everyone needs. Compare all 3 units side by side before signing anything. Because a single good sample proves you got lucky once. 3 identical samples prove the process is ready.
The book goes into real depth on the full approval documentation, the QC framework that flows from the golden sample, and what happens when production deviates from it, which is the next part entirely. Here, let me give you the principle clean. The golden sample is not a checkbox. It is the reference standard that governs every production decision from this moment forward. What's in the sample is the contract, regardless of what else is written. A beautiful specification document and a loose golden sample. The sample wins every time. Which is why the people who treat this step carefully, who order multiples, who run the central review, who distribute with structure, those people have control. And the ones who rush it, who approve from a single unit, who skip the side by side, those people find out what they missed when the container arrives.
So, that's part 5, the sampling phase complete. From the very first rough concept sample through to the moment you sign off on the reference that governs mass production. You now understand why each sample type exists, what question each one answers, how to test against the market instead of against your own assumptions, and how the golden sample system needs to work to actually give you control. The book goes considerably deeper on all of this. The cost structures, the full QC documentation framework, the precise approval language worth using with manufacturers. If sampling is where your current process is shaky, that's the part of the book worth a close read. This was the gate. What comes next is the other side of it. Because after the golden sample is signed, the factory starts. Mass production begins. And that's where the next set of challenges lives. How do you maintain quality across a full production run? What does a proper inspection actually look like? What happens when the factory produces to spec in the sample and then quietly adjusts something in month 2? All of that is part 6, production and quality control. The mass production run, the inspection system, the tools that keep quality from quietly eroding while nobody's watching. And the single most dangerous phrase in this whole business: I'm sure it'll be fine. It usually isn't. See you in part 6.